The Free Library of Philadelphia is proud to present a podcast from our author event series, recorded live at the Central Library on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. To learn more about the Free Library, the Central Library Expansion Project, and how your contribution can help our programs and services for the community, please visit freelibrary.org.
Thank you. How are you all today? Everybody good? Cool. Thanks for coming out.
It hasn't rained yet, thank goodness.
It's great to be back here in Philadelphia. I don't know how many of you know this. I was born just east of Philadelphia in Newark, New Jersey, so it's great to be back home amongst my fellow Newarkans. Just finishing up the book tour. It's been a fairly hellish one. I realized 16 flights during this tour. And over a course of 9 days, I made 12 of them. Over nine nights, nine hotels, 14. So it's cool to be back. At least today I could drive from my house. I live not too far from New York City over here. So I first hit the road before I left. I have four kids, and my youngest daughter says, "So, Dad, what are you going to open up with?" You know, like, I don't know, what am I going to open up with? She goes, "A joke." And she gave me one, which I'm going to share with you now. Why was Cinderella so bad at basketball? Because she ran away from the ball. Thank you all very much. I'm here all week. Two shows Saturday. Don't forget your waitress. Try the veal. The most common question, or we're going to talk to you about health care reform. The most common question a writer is asked when he's on the road is, how tall are you? 6'4". The second most common question a writer is asked is, where do you get your ideas? Like there's a boutique in the village that sells them. And the truth is anything can stimulate an idea. A tabloid headline, boy 16 becomes grandmother, marries Ed Asner. You know what I mean? Anything. You have to kind of open up your brain and you just sort of by the way, I'm going to try to tell you how I write books. This is not a pretty process. It's ugly. I often say that a novel is a little bit like a sausage. You might like the final take. Thank you. You told me not to lean in. I could not. Just kidding. I know I'm taller. It's that height thing again. But it's like a sausage. A novel's like a sausage. You might like the final taste. You probably don't want to know how it was made. But keeping that in mind, I'm going to try actually to tell you how I've come up with a few of the novel ideas, how I actually try to write them, and see what comes out in this stream of consciousness. And then, at the end, I'm going to take a little Q&A. And please, somebody raise your hand when I do the Q&A, because if no one raises your hand, I'm just going to call on you. And not all of you have done the reading, okay? Just someone. Oh, and don't ask, because I get it every night. I'm so tired of it. Boxers or briefs. I'm not answering that one anymore. I'm so tired of that. Bikini mesh. I'm kidding. So I'm going to try to tell you how they come up with some of these ideas. Like I was saying, it comes from anywhere. And most of it is asking, what if? I mean, that's really what all fiction writing is about, asking what if. Fiction writing is every book you've ever read, every novel, is a character traveling down the road of life and how he overcomes obstacles and how they change him. That's what it's all about. So I sit around asking what if all the time. A couple of examples, I wrote a book called Promise Me a few years ago. And Promise Me, the idea for Promise Me came to me when I overheard a couple of teenagers who I loved and adored talking about going out and partying and driving. So I pulled them aside and I said, Promise Me, title of the book, you won't do that. Here's my cell phone, home number, whatever. I don't care if it's 3 in the morning. I don't care what you're on. I don't care where you are. I promise I'll come pick you up and I won't tell your parents or ask questions, but just promise me you won't get in a car with someone who's been drinking and driving. Maybe some of you have made similar promises. Now, in real life, that's it. That's the end of the story. But fiction's asking what if, taking the next step. So what if a teenage girl called my hero? She's in New York City. He goes and he picks her up at 3 in the morning. He drops her off at what he thinks is a friend's house. Next day, she's gone. No one knows where she is. What if? That's the what if. The case of Just One Look. I was picking up the family photograph, something we all do. And as I'm going through the pictures for a second, just a split second, there's a picture in there I didn't take. Turns out the picture was upside down. But just go with me on this. I'm not the brightest bulb. But I ask myself in those moments I get serious, you know, suppose there was a picture in there I didn't take. Suppose that picture changed my whole life. Could I write a book about that? That was the beginning of Just One Look. The problem with these two examples and some of the other ones I'm giving you are they sound kind of neat. Like it's not, you know, like the mind sort of works. And really, it doesn't. The mind is more like, have you ever had one of those nights you can't fall asleep until you remember the name of the dog on Petticoat Junction. You know what I mean? Like, you're sitting in bed and you're like, there's Billy Joe and Bobby Joe and Uncle Joe. What the heck was the name of that stupid dog? And you're sitting there thinking about this, and then you wonder, how did I start thinking of something so stupid? So you try to trace your thoughts back, and actually they bounced all around, all over the place, and it actually started with something that had nothing to do with it. Like, how come Burger King doesn't serve Mountain Dew? You know what I mean? Like, your mind is just bouncing around. That's more, I think, how the book ideas come up with. And so a more specific example of how the mind comes from different angles is the idea I came up with for a book a couple years ago called Tell No One. And Tell No One came to me from two different realities, two different places, two different angles. And you can probably see what I'm talking about when I describe it. So anything can stimulate an idea. So I'm watching a really crummy romance movie on TV. I won't mention the name of the movie, Message in a Bottle. And what struck me about it, I love Nicholas Sparks, good friend of mine, but what struck me about that movie, which you've seen a number of times before, is like, the man's wife dies, right? The man loses his wife, and he's really sad, and he can't go on. And then a hot babe walks by, and he's fine. Have you noticed that ladies in these movies? Angelina Jolie, or Minnie Driver, or in this case, Robin Wright, walks by, and all of a sudden, the guy's perky again. So I ask myself in those moments, I get serious, what about the man who can't go on? What about the man who has truly lost his soulmate? Is there a way I can find redemption for this guy? So this part of the idea is over here. The second part of the idea, to get also somewhat serious, I lost my parents at a fairly young age. I know when I write Meyer and his parents, I overwrite it, I get too sentimental, tough, it's cheaper than therapy, skip it if you don't like it. And I have four kids, as I mentioned, and one day I'm thinking the same way we all do. Wouldn't it be great if my parents were still alive? Wouldn't it be great if they could have met their grandchildren? And I'm looking at a webcam, and I think to myself, what would I do if I saw my parents on this webcam? I take these two ideas and I put them together. A man and a wife, happily married. The wife is murdered. 8 years pass. He can't get over the death of his wife still. He gets an email. He clicks a hyperlink. He sees a webcam. And his dead wife walks by. And the little Homer Simpson part of my brain goes, woohoo! You know, that's that moment. As a writer, it's like a dog getting scratched in the right spot. I'm like, oh, yeah, that's good. Now, the problem with this description is it sounds like this is about 15 minutes of work. This is 3 months of work, ladies and gentlemen. This is 3 months of sitting on the couch going, no, honey, I can't throw out the garbage. I'm working. Can't you see I'm working here? Hardest part of my job, convincing my wife I have one. In the case of Caught, Caught came at me from both one of those sort of what-if angles and also a rant angle, something that makes me angry angle, which I always love to have in books. But the what-if angle came, I was watching one of those Catch the Predator, Dateline-type shows on TV, and I was thinking to myself, what would I do if I saw somebody I knew caught in that show? What would I do if it was somebody I knew, loved, and even trusted, you know, on one of those shows? And I thought, wow, what if I started from that person's viewpoint? So the very first line of Caught is, I knew opening that red door would destroy my life. I want to get you into it right away. That was the first part of the idea. The second part is I have a daughter who just turned 16. And like many of you, I'm dealing with the fun, interesting teenage issues. You know, they turn like 13 in 2 days or whatever, and all of a sudden, like, dad goes from being a hero to can't eat his breakfast cereal, right? You know what I mean? It's like, oh, dad, what are you doing? I'm eating cereal. Eat me now. So dealing with some of those issues I was trying to deal with my own teenager, and all the stuff that they have to deal with the social networking like Facebook, besides the old pressures of drinking and the pressures of partying and the pressures of getting in the right school. So the other part of the story is I have a 17-year-old girl wake up, she's gone, empty from her bed. 3 months pass, she's still gone. And the way these two totally separate stories come together and collide, well, I hope surprise and move you in really kind of cool ways. The rant portion of it was that my lead character in this book is a woman named Wendy Tynes. I've only done a female lead once before. And the reason I love to do the female lead is I'm really tired of bad women in Jeopardy novels. You know the ones I'm talking about where the heroine is naive to the point of blunt brain trauma? You know what I mean? It's like, there's a serial killer loose in the woods. I think I'll rent a secluded cabin, not tell anybody where I'm going, not hook up a phone line, and hang out in my bra and panties all day. I mean, people, please. In today's society, for us to still be putting up with this nonsense. Every time I'm on book tour, at night I flip stations because I'm a guy, and that's what we're genetically programmed to do. We really can't control ourselves. I'm sorry, ladies. But I always go past the Lifetime Network, And every time, they've always been advertising. I don't know how many years this same movie's been advertised, but it stars one of our, you know, one of our really great actresses. I'm talking, of course, about Tori Spelling. Whom, like you, I often mistake for Meryl Streep, the two of them. I mix them up all the time. But the name of this movie, and I'm not making this up, I know some of you have seen this, is called Mother, May I Sleep with Danger. No! This should be a very short film, shouldn't it? Donna Mills or Michelle Lee or Jacqueline Smith, who's ever playing that role, should simply say no. His name is Danger. Clue one, he's not for you, honey. And you know, at the end, she will be in that house. And my favorite part of those scenes is always when they're having the chase, you know, in the house, and the guy falls down the stairs. So then you all stop and take a rest because no one can survive falling down the stairs. He has to be dead. He fell down the stairs. And he gets back up. Anyway, that sort of thing gets me angry and made me want to write a character like Wendy, who I hope you will find to be a realistic single mom. And not one saying, the serial rapist is at the door. Go ahead, three-year-old. Mommy's going to take a shower. You know, that kind of a thing, which angers me. So sometimes when it's done wrong, you'll find a lot of my takes on writing are kind of the opposite. I learn a lot from what people do wrong or what I hear other writers say that annoys me. One of those things, what are the advices if you're a writer out there? I often get the question, research. You must do a lot of research. Should I do a lot of research? So I'm here to tell you, if you're writing a novel, do zero research. None. Not a thing. Thank you all very much. That's all. I'm quasi-facetious on that point, but not really. Here's the problem with research. First of all, people are always saying to me in this book, well, you have Facebook and Google. You must do research. No. If you have a teenager, you know what Facebook is. If you're a woman out there and you're going to go on a date, you Google the guy's name. Come on. Everyone does it. To say, it'd be like having Betamax in the house still. You know what I mean? So it's not anything, there's nothing cutting edge in any of the research that I do. It's just our everyday life. But the reason I recommend you do research if you're writers is twofold. One, research is much more fun than writing. So you'll find any excuse to do research instead of writing. I'm writing a scene in Park Avenue in New York. But first, I have to go to Park Avenue and smell the hot dog stands and watch the girls walk by. No. You've been there, or Google Earth it or know it. Write the scene with your imagination. Remember, writing, as George Carlin once said, I make up for a living, library, so I can't say the word. That's writing. So that's number one. Don't use research as an excuse not to write. Second part of it is, have you ever read that book where the author did a ton of research, so he keeps slowing it down to throw those cute little factoids in? Not a problem with me. I don't know anything. So don't do research if you're going to do it. My favorite quote on writing, and if you learn nothing else today, like you're learning something, learn this. My favorite quote on writing comes from Elmore Leonard, who says, think about this, I try to cut out all the parts you'd normally skip. Isn't that brilliant? And I do. I try to write on every page, every paragraph, every sentence, every word. I ask, is this compelling? Is this gripping? Is this moving the story forward? And if it's not, I got to find a way to change it. It doesn't mean you can't have themes. You have to. You do. I mean, Caught is really, when you read it, hope you'll find it's a novel about forgiveness. You kidding me? You can't have character development. You have to. I can write the fastest-paced plot in the world without a character you care about. It's not going to work. It's like owning the most expensive car in the world if there's no petrol. Petrol. I was touring in England. You're not going anyplace. You have to have all of those components. But even those components have to be gripping. Setting is a great example. Setting is one of those things that should be on every page and almost never be mentioned. Or you find the small thing that brings it all to life. I'll give you two quick examples. I'm a member of a group called the Adams Roundtable, and those who have heard Mary Higgins Clark speak, Mary tells the same story. Mary's one of the members also. Carol Higgins Clark, Lawrence Block, Susan Isaacs, Peter Straub, Linda Fairstein. So anyway, one day we're talking about what's the scariest noise in the world. Is it a baby crying, a mother screaming, a father in pain, or whatever? And one of the members goes, no. You're all alone in that cabin I was just describing before. You're all alone in the woods. You know you're all alone. And from upstairs, you hear the toilet flush. That's the moment you're always looking for as a writer, the flush toilet moment, if you will. If I'm describing to you, and also bring, if I'm describing to you Route 23 in Wayne, New Jersey, I'm not going to tell you it's four lanes across the divider in the middle and the cars go too fast. No, but I will tell you on Route 23 in Wayne, New Jersey, there's a tattoo parlor called, think about it, tattoos while you wait. Like, how else would you do it? Here's my arm. Put a skull and crossbones on there. I'll be back in about an hour. That will tell you more about Route 23 in Wayne, New Jersey than pages of description. And also a certain reality to our area. I count you guys pretty much as New Jerseyans, too, since I'm from home. This is my home city of Newark. I was going down on book tour to some place a little south of here. I won't mention the name of the place. I think it's called Chesapeake, Virginia, or maybe Maryland. I forget which one. Anyway, I'm there on book tour, and they're going to say, when you go to the event, you're going to go across the Great Bridge. Wait till you see the Great Bridge. Now, I live in New Jersey, not far from the Washington Bridge. I'm picturing a Great Bridge. The Great Bridge is about the length of this room. I'm like, why don't you call it the little piece of crap bridge? Why do you call it the Great Bridge? In New Jersey, on Route 17 in Ramsey, New Jersey, we have one of those no-tell motels. You know, this guy's nodding. Thank you, sir. You know, one of those no-tell motels, hourly rates, with a sign saying, now featuring towels. You know those ones? Color TV. I love that color. Like someone still has black and white TV. And the word color is spelled out. The C is in red. The O is in green. In case you don't know what the word color means. And on Route 17 in Ramsey, New Jersey, the name of this no-tell motel is, I love it, the Fair Motel. We're not great. We're not even good. We're fair. What else do you need? You're committing an indiscretion. Fair is fine for you. That tells you more than pages and pages of boring stuff about a particular place. Find the moments that kind of bring it to life. There's three things that make a writer. How do I put this? Let's see how we can do this to sit differently. As a writer, you have to read a lot. I don't know any musicians who don't listen to a lot of music. I don't know any writers who don't read a lot. But, and this is the key to being a writer, while you're reading, feel guilty you're not writing. In fact, I feel guilty all the time when I'm doing anything else other than writing. Writing is the only thing I do where I don't think I should be doing something else. I always say there's three things that make a writer. Two are obvious, the third is not so. First two, inspiration, being inspired, and perspiration, doing the work. But the third and most important really is desperation. And that is, I'm not fit to do anything else. Like have a real job. Seriously, I'm not. It's like I was on a panel with a bunch of other writers, and we were asked, we get this question a lot, what would you be if you weren't a writer? And one of them said, a U.S. senator. I'm like, oh, please. I don't know. I'd be like a duvet cover. I have no other marketable skills. I'm forgetful. I'm not the brightest bulb you ever meant. I'm lazy. I have horrible work habits. This is all I can do. And that desperation drives me. If you can do anything other than write, do it. Because writing is a calling that kind of way. Not in a magical, kind of muse way. More like my mother's voice. Like, what, you don't want to be with me? Friday night, no phone call, nothing? You'd rather be out with your friends? That's what the muse is. Every time I'm doing something else, there's a little voice that says you should be writing. To be a more well-rounded person, because I have absolutely no hobbies other than I have the four kids and I write, a couple of years ago, I took up golf. Why I didn't break glass and smash it in my eye, I have no idea. It would have been much more preferable to playing golf, but I took up golf. But even those moments that I'm enjoying it, even when I'm out there and it's a beautiful day and I'm playing okay or reasonably, there's always a voice that's saying, you should be home writing. Of course, that's the guy I'm playing with, but that's beside the point. That voice is always there. I know I hit you now as a bastion of security, but trust me, I have my neuroses. Just go with me on this. And that never stops. I've written, I don't know, 20-something books. This is my 10th in a row, I think, New York Times bestseller. I still have all those doubts never go away. Only bad writers think they're good. If you have a writer up here who says, my book is pretty good, they stink. Trust me. They're horrible. Only bad writers think they're good. The rest of us are, I'm writing the book now. I'll be writing my book, and I'm going, oh, my God, this stinks. I was so good before. What happened to me? When did I lose it? How will I ever get it back? 5 minutes later, oh, my God, this is sheer genius. Someone's going to read that book that's already out there and never give this work of Shakespearean proportions really a chance. Goes on every day, 5 or 5 minutes. When I finish a book, a little voice in my head goes, that's it. You're done. You're going to have to get a real job now. It's the Steve Martin playing the banjo with his nose saying, just wake up at 6 in the morning to go to the pharmacy and sell flare pens. All that. Now it's all over for you. That goes on all of the time. That never ends. If you want it to end by, if you think being published will end it, you're wrong. I think maybe when it ends is when you start to phone it in. I have those doubts every single time. It never, ever gets better. You have to also do the work. I don't like when writers make it sound like an artistic process. One of the ones you'll sometimes hear writers say is, I'm sitting at my desk and God goes through me and my fingers start moving around. No. Amateurs wait for inspiration to arrive. The rest of us just get to work. You really have to do it. This is the tough love portion. You have time to write. If you don't have time to write, then that voice isn't in your head. That's cool. Don't write. I don't need the competition. That voice has to be in your head, and you have to find time. Mary Higgins Clark, again, to use Mary, when she was 42 years old, had five kids. Her husband died. Her mother-in-law died, and she had to raise the kids herself and work. So she wrote from 5 a.m. to 6:30 a.m. before she woke up the kids for school. So don't tell me you don't have time to write. It's an excuse. And much like, this isn't weight gain, it's water retention. Eventually, we have to face the truth. It was the great 20th century philosopher Cher who said, Cher said, excuses won't lift your butt, okay? Write that down. Put it on your computer. Live it. Become it. I love being a writer. One of the other panels I was on with a bunch of writers that annoy me, we were asked, all of us were number one New York Times bestsellers, and they said, what's the downside of being a number one New York Times bestseller? Nothing. There's no downside. It's the coolest thing in the world. We are the luckiest five people in the States in the entire world. Don't tell me there's anything wrong. I love it. I mean, I really love being a writer. Sometimes the traveling, I always quote the great Dan Fogelberg, who said, the audience is heavenly, but the traveling is hell. But I do love always kind of being here and doing this. And this is the cool part for me as a writer, because now it's caught as finally a book. It wasn't a book when I finished writing it. A writer without a reader is a man who claps with one hand. You are the other hand. Berkeley's Tree in the Woods, if a tree falls and nobody hears it, does it make a sound? If I write a book and nobody, reads it, does it make a sound? When I'm on a panel again with those annoying writers, there's always the one writer who says, I write only for myself. I don't care if anybody reads it. That's like saying, I talk only to myself. I don't care. From the beginning of time, writing is communication without you guys reading it. That's the cool part. There's an Arab expression, when one man dies, a whole universe dies. When one of you reads Caught, a whole new universe of Dan and Wendy, and by the way, Wynn, for those who are Myron Boltar fans, appears in Caught, comes to life in your head different from everybody else's head. And that's still the part that jazzes me. You're going to take Caught to bed tonight at 9 o'clock, say, I'm just going to read for a half hour, 4 in the morning, you're going to be bleary-eyed and happy. That turns me on when you tell me that, okay? When you send me those emails, damn you, you kept me up all night, I love it. It turns me on. Keep it coming. That's the magic. That's the beauty for me right now when the book is coming out. And in closing, before I take some questions, I just want to thank the library. I mean, I don't know any great community that doesn't have a great library. It just doesn't happen. This is supporting your library is great for property value, if nothing else. Every great community needs a great library. So thank you all very, very much. And I'd be happy. I would be happy to entertain, if not answer, any questions you might have. Who's going to be first? Hen. This lady right here. I think they want to give you a microphone, so you just wait for that microphone. I feel like Phil Donahue. Caller, are you there? Yeah.
Hi. I finished Caught last night at 2 a.m.
Don't tell anybody how it ends, okay?
I won't, but thank you for the ending.
Oh, thank you.
And I just want to say one of my greatest pleasures has been reading your book, especially Myron.
Oh, thank you.
One of my other greatest pleasures is telling my other friends about it, and then they come back and say, I loved Myron.
Oh, so thank you very much.
I just wanted to say thank you. I don't really
Thank you. No, that's I recently reread Caught, and I was totally fooled by the ending. I mean, I had no idea who did it. I had to call me on the phone, and yeah, the guy right there. Thank you very much.
Is it pronounced Crimstein or Crimestein?
I'm never going to reveal. I think the first audio made a Crimstein, so that's how we go with it. A lot of times, I just make these words up, like Myron's last name. I don't know what I was on at the time. And Boletar, I just made the word up. It's a bit like, Boletar or Boltar? I'm like, all right, Boletar. I mean, I just made it up anyway. But I think it's Crimstein. I always think of it as Crimstein. But there you go. Because it rhymes with crime, right? And it shows Crimstein on crime, but I made it Crimstein on crime. Have it your way. We'll change it. Yes, right here. Hold on, wait, we have to get the microphone. Or I can just repeat the question. Is when somebody I know.
You met.
When is actually one of the few, you know, whenever I write these, the cool characters, my friends always think they're based on them. You know, it's like the guy who gets all the chicks. That's clearly me, right? You know, they never go, that loser with halitosis. That was me, right? They never think that. But when is the only character I actually did based on my college roommate, who lives on the main line of Philadelphia, not far from here, was a member of both Marion and Pine Valley, blonde, gorgeous, good-looking college roommate, and when we would go to fraternity parties when we were in college, before we'd go out, he would look in the mirror and go, it must suck to be ugly. I swear to God, he used to say that. The only difference between the real Wynn and the fake Wynn is that the real Wynn can't fight his way out of a paper bag. But because I've acknowledged him several times in books, people know he's Wynn, and he kind of uses it. Like, he give people stern looks to get better table reservations or better tea times. And what's funny is he owns a, so some of you may even know him if you live around here, he owns a clothing line now called Lilly Pulitzer, which some of you I'm sure know, the loud pinks and greens. So this shirt would be much too mellow for Lilly Pulitzer, to give you an idea of what their stuff is like. And the first time I was going to be on national TV, I think this was 2002 with Brian Gumbel, Wynn calls me and says, you know, we have men's ties now. I didn't know they made men's clothes. I'm still not sure they do. And he says, you must wear my tie on TV. And I said to him, so I told my publicist, and she's like, I don't know, Bryant might start talking about the tie, that's so wild. So I told him, I might not be able to wear the tie. And Wynn says, oh, no, you will wear the tie. And I said, no, you're not really Wynn. But I wore the tie. And if you ever see me on national TV ever, I've always worn the tie. Except this year he contacts me beforehand and he says, instead of a tie, we're sending out shirts. I'm like, oh my God, I'm going to look like Harvey Firestein, Liberace's like love child in Fire Island. I mean, actually, I found one of the shirts was mellow and I was able to wear it with Big Al Roker this year. So, he's not here today, but he actually came once to my signing this year in New York. So I finished by telling this story. And I said, and I'm not going to tell you who he is, but he's in the room. Took them 3 seconds to pick him out. And he had a longer line to sign books than I did. Anybody else? This lady right here.
First of all, I grounded myself from reading Caught because I have a final exam on Monday. And I started it last night. It was up all night. My question is, Tenafly, character.
Yeah.
Is that a personal experience? Or
I don't want to spoil anything for the people in the room. Tenafly is the name of a character in Caught. No, I just made him up. Oh, thank you. Yes, thank you. I wanted a little bit of, and one of the things I love, I never made an issue I don't want to somehow explore, so I wanted to talk about a lot of the fathers that were losing their jobs, but in a humorous way, and how they've kind of handled it in our community, and Tenafly just popped up. You know, a lot of times the answer to the question of how did you create a character is, he was just there. She was just there. It's really weird. You know, I want to come up with better answers. Like I have for Wynn, I have a good answer for Wynn. I don't have a good answer for Tenafly. Anybody else? Yes, right here in the pink.
Wait.
You're mad at you. Sorry.
Which character you write about is most like you?
Which is the most Dudley creative? No. Well, a lot of writers don't necessarily like to admit this, but my series hero, Myron Bolitar, is me with wish fulfillment. I mean, he's stronger, he's faster, he's funnier, he's more loyal. I haven't beaten two areas. One, I'm a better dancer. I'll demonstrate later. And two, I'm slightly wiser in the ways of women. This is no great shakes. It's like saying syphilis is better than gonorrhea. We're not talking about two geniuses here, but I've been with the same woman since I was a sophomore in college, and Myron's love life is a disaster. He's a better basketball player, though I should point out, in fairness to myself, I was a collegiate All-American basketball player. What I leave off of that was I wasn't picked All-American by Sports Illustrated or Sporting News, but I was picked All-American by that paper equally in the know. I'm talking, of course, about the Jewish Post and Opinion of Indianapolis. I'm not kidding. I'm a Jewish All-American basketball player. Somehow, through great and painstaking research, the crack squad at the Jewish Post and Opinion of Indianapolis, Indianapolis being the great bastion of Jewish thought, found 5 Jews who played college basketball that year and made a team. It was me, Heshi Moshe, and 2 guys from Yeshiva. And to give the somewhat serious side of that question, the difference between Myron and I, which has really helped us grow as a writer, is that he has what I want, and I have what he wants. I've already alluded to part of it. Myron has his parents still alive. And the relationship that Myron enjoys with his parents and the problems, you know, as they get older, are ones I imagine I would be having had my parents survive. So I'm a little jealous of them there. Myron's whole goal in life is to get married and move in the burbs and have kids, which is my life. And I can't give that to him. If I give it to him, you know the series is probably over. So that tension as time has gone on has worked well for the two of us. Right here. I guess you do. I'm just following the rules. I don't make them.
I have two questions.
Yes, okay.
One is, if I remember, are there going to be any United States movies?
Mm-hmm.
And when is the next Myron Bolitar book coming out?
Okay, let me start with the movie question. For those who don't know, Tell No One was made into a French film that's readily available on your Netflix downloads or your DVD store. It was the largest grossing foreign film in the U.S. the year it came out here, the largest grossing movie in France that year. It's really good. I'm in it. For those who see it, if you watch it, there's a scene when Kristen Scott Thomas and Francois Clouzet are on the train station, and I follow them. I'm scary, bad man in the background. I'm in it for about 8 seconds. I don't speak, but I was brilliant, really. I steal the film. And thank you. Yeah, you agree, I steal the film. And it was nominated for 9 of Césars, which is their version of the Oscar, and somehow I was overlooked for Best Supporting Actor. I'm not saying there's anti-American feelings still in France, but I don't know how else to explain it. The movie is being remade as an American film by Kennedy Marshall, the producers Kennedy Marshall, who have made everything from E.T. and Saving Private Ryan, Sixth Sense, Benjamin Button. So they're really great. I hope they make a decent film of it. Long Lost is in a various stage of production. Caught is currently being optioned as we speak. Innocent. But I don't talk about it until I'm actually at the premiere. I mean, I could put my kids to college several times over for the money Hollywood's given me to not make movies. So I don't really quite understand the business. I kind of keep a little bit of an arm's distance. I had a great experience with France. We'll see what happens. Second part, when's the next Myron Bolitar? Probably next year. I'm on page 3 of the new book, and Myron's on all 3 pages. If he stays, I don't yet know. It's still early on. That gentleman right there.
I'm about to go off on vacation and read Long Lost on the beach. What was your inspiration for it?
Long Lost? That's a really good question. I don't remember anymore. Actually, I think I wanted... Oh, I was in Paris on book tour, and for the movie like a million times, and I looked across the river, and I said, wow, what is that cool-looking palace? And they said, no, that's our police station. So, wow, you French, man. So I got a tour of it. I said, I got to get Myron in this place. That was part one of the idea. And then I don't want to give it away because this is one where I started with the ending. And when I first thought of this ending, I said, nah, it's too crazy even for me. And the ending just wouldn't stop staying with me, so I based the book around it. Third thing was I created a character in The Final Detail and Darkest Fear, Therese Collins, who Myron was briefly dating, and I had hinted 10 years ago, had a tragic past. And I thought after 10 years, it was time to let you know what that tragic past was. So all those things stick in a blender, twirl together, and it comes out. Thank you. Anybody else? Right here? Do one more question, I guess? No? One more. Here's our last question right here. Make it a good one, sir. Pressure's on you. No, just kidding.
Hi, Harlan. I've read all your books. So what do I do until your next book comes out?
She's read all of my books. Just repeat the question, and he doesn't know what to do.
Any favorite authors that have your style?
I usually suggest rebuying, and then rereading mine. And that's not self-serving at all. I don't recommend crime writers anymore, or mystery, or thrillers, whatever you want to call it, because you guys always put it online, and then my friend gets mad and says, dude, you forgot me, you know, and I do always forget them. So probably I don't really have any unique ones. And what I used to do is I would recommend somebody that people didn't know. I would read the book, and I'd go out, and I'd be happy to promote it. And a couple of years ago, a friend of mine from college sent me a book. He had a couple out that didn't do very well, and I read it and gave one of those blurbs, great book, you know. And I was all ready to go out and promote it, and I went to the first bookstore. I won't mention the name of the bookstore, but its initials are B&N. And I saw my book was number 2, and this is 2003. I was really kind of thrilled. And then his book was number 1. His name was Dan Brown, Da Vinci Code. So a year later, when Just One Look came out, and I was still number 2 behind Da Vinci Code, I called Dan and said, I'm not recommending your book anymore. And I'm not doing this anymore. Do I want to create another Dan Brown? My favorite author of all time is Philip Roth. I just read a very good book called City of Thieves by David Benoff, which I recommend very highly if you want to, not a thriller, but it's a sort of adventure novel about two guys during the siege of Leningrad. And that was really good. And if you're into self-help, I like The Happiness Project by Gretchen Rubin, and I hate self-help books. All right, thank you all very, very much. And I'll turn it back over to...
Thank you very much to Harlan. We have to have him back, right? Now you're stuck. All right, we'll see you upstairs.
All right, where am I going? Following you back. I got to go with him. We'll see you in a little while.
Thank you for listening to a podcast from the Free Library's Author Event Series. If you live in Philadelphia or are planning a visit and would like to attend an author event, information is available at freelibrary.org.